Hope you enjoyed that. And I believe I have Terry Harrison on the line. Are you there, Terry?
I am.
Oh, great. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I've got Terry on today to talk about dry farming, and especially with regard to grapes. Is that correct, Terry?
Right.
So what is your history with grapes and dry farming? How did you get to be involved in this? And then I suppose we can say what dry farming is, I suppose.
Sure. Well, dry farming is farming with little or no irrigation. And I got into it rather by accident. We bought our farm here in 1973, and we had the well tested. It was in the spring, and they tested it for 2 hours and lots of water. And I was pretty ignorant about these things at that time. I was an engineer moving into agriculture, and didn't realize that a two-hour test in the spring meant nothing. So when we, after we'd gotten our vineyard established, we discovered we really were short of water, and so we and we found that the vines really didn't need much water.
Ah.
Now, ours was an extreme case with wide spacing of the vines, 8 by 12. We have a deep clay loam soil, and vigorous. They were on a vigorous rootstock, a vigorous variety, Sauvignon Blanc. And so I figured that the storage of water for each vine was something like 2,000 gallons in the ground.
That's what it requires over its season?
No, that's not what it requires. It's a lot more than what it requires.
Oh, okay.
So we ended up growing a cover crop, which we stayed green most of the summer, in order to compete with the vines for that water. Hmm. But as I say, this was, you know, a really extreme case.
Right. Now, dry farming, you know, from what I've been reading, really is going back to the old ways, really, of giving, taking what nature gives us.
That's right. It California vineyards were farmed without irrigation for over 100 years, and it's really only since about 1968, when drip emitters were introduced from Israel, that the vineyards started to be watered. And since then, the trend has been toward a closer spacing and riparian rootstocks, that is, rootstocks from grapes that originated, growing near streams naturally. And so the rootstocks don't go down very far, and if they're irrigated, there's no incentive for them to go down very far. So you end up with a, well, as John Williams at Frog's Leap puts it, you end up with a basketball-sized root ball.
A basket, okay. And that's about all you got, yeah. Yeah. So that's not good enough for production?
Well, you get a different character in the grape if the roots are going down deeply and are in contact with the minerals and the entire soil profile. The other factor is that planting the vines close together is a means of stressing the vines, particularly on red varieties, because it's thought that, and it's probably true, that the stress grapes from stressed vines have more character than those that grow as vigorously as they can.
Oh, very interesting. So going back a bit, it's interesting that so not all grape rootstock is created equal. They really are wet rootstocks and then the more dry rootstocks. That is a substantial difference then.
Right.
And what is the production difference?
Well, you see, most premium grape vineyards, such as you find in the North Coast, including Sonoma and Napa and Mendocino County, Lake County, they limit the production. And dry farming will do that to a certain extent, but they often go through and thin the bunches so that the production is about 4 tons to the acre. So the vine will produce more grapes than that, but the quality that the winemakers require, they try and keep it down to around 4 tons to the acre.
Oh, interesting. So they're sort of artificially cutting, even though they're overproducing in a way with irrigation, they're cutting it back for quality.
That's right. Well, they can overproduce even without irrigation. In our case, we had over 6 tons to the acre a couple of years in the 22 years that we had our vineyard, and the grapes ripen late, so then you're worried about rains coming before the crop is ready to pick.
Mm-hmm.
The quality was probably not as good as when we had more like 4 or 5 tons to the acre.
Oh, I get you. So yeah, so it's a real it takes a lot of working out to really optimize either method, basically.
Yes, and there's different ways to do it. Now, I'm involved with Community Alliance of Family Farmers, and we have had 2 field days at Dry Farm Vineyards. One last year in Dry Creek Valley at Paul Bernier's vineyard, and the other was yesterday at Frog's Leap. And we have one more of these scheduled at Buckland's Old Hill Vineyard in near Glen Ellen, and that's on the 28th of this month. You know, you hear a little different story from all of these vineyard people that are each one working with different varieties and different soils and different soil depths and so on. In the case of Paul Bernier's, we visited a hillside vineyard that he says most of the soil had washed away long before he was farming it.
Uh-huh.
And one of the techniques that's used is to put, he uses, they do at Frog's Leap also, is to put compost on every year or in Bernier's case, every several years. And so you build up the soil's water-holding capacity that way.
Oh, I see. Now, one thing you mentioned, I was reading that with dry farming, you have to create, and it's also one of the problems that which you mentioned is also is the erosion problems from dry farming. I know you mentioned that you did do a cover crop, but also that a lot of people leave it in a dust mulch. Is that correct?
Well, we used a permanent cover crop, which was not tilled for several years, and then we would renew it maybe every 4 or 5 years. at Frog's Leap, they do exactly what you said. They feel that they can conserve the moisture by cultivating and getting a rather fine soil layer on top, and this prevents water from wicking up from down below. Now, it's interesting, when we went out in their vineyard yesterday, they showed us that this year they had not cultivated as much, so it was relatively rough, and water then was wicking up, and they did that because the over average rainfall we had last year, and of course the rains also came late in the spring, so
that's right.
They felt there was actually more water in the ground than they wanted the vines to have access to.
So now, how do you actually measure that, the water content in the ground by the root system?
There's various technology for doing that. There's a neutron probe, which is a pretty expensive piece of equipment.
It sounds it, yeah.
You put that down at various depths. You can put that down at various depths and get readings. And, of course, you can actually, if you have probes of that type or other types, at different levels, you can actually see how the water profile's going down with depth. And then, of course, there's situations where you have relatively shallow soil, often on hillsides, but they're still doing some dry farming on some of those hillsides. Now, we're not representing that dry farming is applicable for all situations. I mean, farming is site-specific, and there probably are a lot of situations where some water is necessary. But there's also probably a lot of cases where there's more water put on the vines than necessary.
Right. Now, how is this being taken up around the world and around the country, or even around the county? Is there a pretty substantial movement to that now, or is it just experimentation?
Well, there's people who have been doing it for decades, and there are some fairly large vineyards that are dry farmed. At our next dry farming workday, we're going to have someone speak who has 100 acres up on the hilltop in the Mayacamas Mountains. Bonnie Dune and Santa Cruz Mountains have put in a large dry-farmed vineyard. I wouldn't say there's a real rush to it, but the vineyards that are doing it are often ones that have a very good reputation for their wine, and so there's certainly interest in it. We had a sellout at both our field day last year in Dry Creek and the one yesterday in St. Helena.
Oh, incredible. That shows something. And when is that next one up in the Mayacamas going to be?
It's actually near Glen Ellen in another vineyard. It's July 28th from 8:30 to 11:30. And information on that is on the CAFF website, caff.org, if you click on the calendar. And we are asking people to sign up in advance.
Oh, excellent. And we're listening to Terry Harrison, who is involved with dry farming for wine grapes. Now, did this work with edible grapes as well, eating grapes? Is that being done with at all?
I don't know of anyone that is. I mean, we're talking about 4 tons to the acre. Mm-hmm. And Thompson seedless grapes grown in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Valley, they're looking for 15 tons to the acre.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, a Thompson seedless grape is a Thompson seedless grape. They're not as concerned about acid sugar balances and particular flavors and so on. So, and also the table grape, there are table grapes grown in their north coast, and they have marvelous flavor. But they're pretty small vineyards at this point that I know of, and in the valley, of course, you're talking about areas that get 10 inches or less of rainfall a year.
Right.
So that makes it hard to produce 15 tons to the acre without irrigating.
Right, indeed.
I could talk a little bit about some other crops if you'd like.
Oh, please do.
Our experience here, we not only had the vineyard, but we have a small apple and pear orchard.
Oh, okay.
And I've talked to a number of fruit growers in Sonoma County. And traditionally there, too, they were dry farmed. And the fruit, a lot of it went into processing. So they weren't concerned with getting really big apples, such as some of the irrigated orchards get.
Right.
With our lack of water here, our apple trees produce very nice fruit with a minimum of water. We do water them some.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of a Rome orchard in Sebastopol, where a couple of years they got 40 tons to the acre. Of course, they have a pleasant Gold Ridge loam that goes down 40 feet.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. That will do it, do you? Yeah.
Yeah, but it certainly is practical to raise fruit dry farmed. If you want, you know, really big apples for fresh, it helps to be able to put some water on.
Right, exactly. Now, like grapes, though, is it the same where the when you're not irrigating, the flavors are more enhanced because of the less water?
I feel it really is. When we were, my wife and I had Sonoma Antique Apple Nursery, and we propagated old and unusual varieties of apples and pears for 20 years. And when we got started, we put on some apple tastings, and one of our favorite apples is Spitzenbergs, and we didn't have, our own trees were bearing yet, so we got some from a dry-farmed orchard in Sebastopol, and they were fairly small, you know, apples, 2.5 inches and so on. And then we got some from a orchard in Mendocino County where they were irrigating copiously. And to me, it was like there's the same amount of flavor in each apple, but it's just distributed over a bigger volume with the bigger ones. So
yeah.
I think for the home orchard that a minimum amount of water gives you really superior fruit.
Right. And now if somebody wants to actually turn to dry farming, say in their vineyard or in their orchard, can you do it with the existing plants and trees that you have, or would you really have to replace them? What is the procedure there?
Well, in some cases, there have been conversions. We were in an orchard, I mean, a vineyard yesterday at Frog's Leap that had originally been irrigated, and then they had gone over to dry farming. If you have a shallow rootstock, it's going to be harder to do. And if the plants are planted very close together. I do have information on some consultants that will help people with that. And anyone that wants to email me at fresh@hughes.net and request that, I'd be glad to send it to them. There's about six consultants who have indicated that they're interested in working in this area.
Oh, excellent. That will help because it's that fear factor, I imagine, when you feel like you want to do something, but what is the impact of that?
And there's another resource. CAF is part of California Ag Water Stewardship Initiative. This is a group of about six organizations that are working in this area of reduced irrigation or dry farming. And the website for that is agwaterstewards.org. And they have several case studies, interviews with vineyard managers who are dry farming and in different parts of the state.
I mean, it seems, what with the, even though we had an average year this year, we're looking at dry years. So it certainly behooves to look at a different system when you see, the Russian River going dry and lots of low flows. So it seems we need to spread the word about it as fast as possible.
Well, that's the way we feel. We're working in that direction.
Indeed. And perhaps you could give out your email addresses and your again, and then
sure.
Everyone can write them down.
It's fresh, F-R-E-S-H, at Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S.net.
Well, thank you very much, Terry Harrison, for giving us this overview on dry farming of orchards and vineyards.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
I really appreciate it, and I hope you do really well, and it's great that you're putting the education out there to make a difference.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Oh, lovely, lovely, beautiful ballad by Fotheringay, The Sea. Well, talking about the sea, we have David Little here with me, and he has a farm which is scattered over the coastal, plots scattered over the coastal area of Sonoma County.
Marin County.
Marin
Tamales,
County.
Tamales and Sonoma.
Okay, yeah. You're straddling the borders.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Okay. And David is of the Little Organic Farms, and it's David Little, so it's not little in size, but little in name. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's all relative.
And now, David, you've been practicing dry farming.
Since 1995.
Since 1995. And now you grow vegetables, mainly vegetables, using that method?
That's right, yeah. Whatever, we're always trying to push the boundaries with what crops we can grow. Different years, different crops do better. And we're always experimenting, but mostly vegetables and potatoes, tomatoes, winter squash, cucumbers, beans, sunchokes, I'm missing a good a bunch of
weeds. That's quite alive. Yeah. Well, that sounds incredible. I mean, to a layperson, that sounds a lot of crops that, you know, usually require quite a bit of water to make them grow in this climate. Perhaps you can give us some secrets about dry farming and how it's so successful for you.
Well, the dry farming that I do is nothing that I invented. It's a ancient coastal practice going back to the early 1800s and the 49er Gold Rush, and they supplied most of the produce to San Francisco at that time, barging it out of Tamales into San Francisco, and it's a soil tillage technique that I call the art of working the soil, just because certain years you have a drought, certain years you have water, certain things happen where it's a general technique, but it's can vary depending on the seasons and the plots and the climate and all the microclimates that are in the area. And it's basically we disc as early as we can in the spring, inevitably get stuck or a couple times in the spring with our tractors trying to do too much or too early. And then we plow, and then we disc again. And then the last final disking is with a disc and a roller. And the roller presses it down. The disc, the plow turns it over, the disc cuts it up, makes it smooth tilth, and then the roller presses it down, and that's what holds the moisture. And for, in layman's term, what I like to tell people at farmers markets is it's basically, if you have a sheet of water, cookie sheet full of water, and you put a dry sponge on that cookie sheet, pretty soon all the water is going to be in the sponge. And if you put a piece of cellophane over the sponge, you're going to hold that moisture for a long period of time in that sponge. So the cookie sheet is the pasture land and the surrounding hills. The sponge is the part that you disc up, and the cellophane would be like the disc that presses it down and holds the moisture.
I see. So really you're using the earth as that
it creates
impermeable
a crust.
Layer.
It creates a crust on it. And you can hold it for long periods of time. We can work up the ground in March, April, and plant in July, August, and still have enough moisture to get some results. And in some cases, like we just recently, I keep my disc and roller right there, and we disc ahead of our planting a lot of times. And like we disc and rolled maybe about a week ago, less than 5 days ago, and we went to plant today, and there was much more moisture in the ground today than there was when I first started disking. So the moisture came up in that time, but couldn't escape because of the pressed surface.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so you can do crops, and you can also irrigate with those dry farming techniques and have some really good results with using less water.
Right. At the very least, use less. Yeah. Now, so really, the water really wicks up then. Using that method, you're really bringing the water to the surface so the roots can utilize it then.
Exactly. And in some cases, like in the drought years where, you know, if you have moisture, the weeds come. And if you can't, I do a lot of acres for our operation, and we can't get to it, so the weeds come. So we keep disking and rolling. But inevitably, the moisture is going to escape. And so in some cases, we actually have to double plow, where it's kind of an unheard-of practice where we have to go back at the end of the season or towards the end of the planting season and plow again and start over again and bring that moisture back up and try and hold it again until we get planted.
Oh, interesting.
So that's why I call it the art, you know, of working the soil, because you have to look and feel and observe and kind of intuit what needs to be done.
Well, that's it. It seems, as you say, every year, every part of year, it's different. Do you go with any just your own predictions about what's going to happen, or do you get outside help to predict how that year's going to be?
I like to talk to a lot of people, a lot of the old timers. They're dying off fast, and now I'm an old timer. But just to kind of compare notes and what are you doing? And are you starting to plant yet? Are you starting to work ground yet? And a lot of the you can tell by the silage guys when they're cutting. There's different indicators what it's good, and you know, I have a few people out there that really that grew up on ranches out in West Marin, West Sonoma, and they just know what needs to be done, and so I consult with them a lot. And remember the old saying, it was so boring, all he talked about was the weather. Well, when you're farming, that's all you talk about. That's all that's important is the weather.
Very, very true.
Yeah.
That I don't know if it affects you. Do you, does it make a difference for, say, crop insurance? If you, I know some farmers get crop insurance. Now, because you're doing a different method, does that make any difference, or you just ignore that anyway? Or
I just kind of ignore it.
Yeah.
I blame myself if it goes wrong. You know?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? When you've done regular irrigation farming, do you find it, you know, as a comparison, dry farming pretty much as reliable? I mean, how often have you, say, lost crops? Does that really happen?
Yeah, that happens. Like with tomatoes, dry farm tomatoes, you get the blight. We've seen that quite a bit out here. And that's the risky part of trying to grow tomatoes on the coast. But, you know, I started out dry farming in 95, so I really didn't know anything about irrigation or irrigating. And I've had to teach myself how to do that for different crops or parcels that I had water for, you know, crops like broccoli, cauliflower, kale, chard, and lettuces that all need water. And so I'm still learning about irrigation, and this year actually we did some comparison plots where we dry farmed some beans right next to some dry beans, right next to some irrigated dry beans, and so we're just kind of paying attention to what's going on there, and it's really interesting.
Huh. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how much of a lens of water is collected under a field, say? I don't know how you can gauge that. I mean, the water you're capturing or keeping there, is there a rule of thumb or anything like that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I probably wouldn't be the person to ask for that. I just kind of feel it out and observe what's going on with the moisture, and we're always down there, you know, with kicking the dirt over to see how far down the moisture is. You know, just kind of doing it like that, and in some areas you just know are going to be dry, and
And have any crops been a failure? You know, you've tried them, and you know they just don't work, or they just really need a different approach.
Sometimes some years melons, you know, out here dry farmed, I've had people say, oh, it was the best tasting melon I've ever tasted. And then other years I couldn't get a melon, or I had got a lot of melons and there was no flavor.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't commercially do melons. I just do them for the fun and to, but the stuff like that. But overall with dry farming, it's not so much crop failure. It's a matter of getting your yield up. The old timers always told me when I first started, if you did less acres and paid attention more closely to less acres than you can with all the acres that you're doing, you might be able to get as good a results or as good a yields with the few acres that you do. Rather than trying to grow big and do a lot of acres. So.
Right.
So with dry farming, you get a lot less yield. You know, my main crop is potatoes, and, you know, 7,000 pounds an acre, 10,000 pounds an acre. My best year was 14,000 pounds an acre. People like Full Belly and Cape A and some of the bigger organic farms get 30,000, 40,000 pounds an acre.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so they get three or four times more than me, you know.
That's staggering, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it still can be, you can still make a living out of doing it, even without that production.
I'm hanging on.
Is that, you know, overheads are less, but obviously not paying for the water and
yeah,
some things
like
that.
Yeah, but I think there can be more of a tillage, more diesel fuel, more time on the tractor. You know, it's so, yeah, there's some trade-offs.
Yeah. And I know you speak to the old timers. Are there other groups that you work with to help spread the knowledge and get the word out?
I just think it's. I think tomatoes, dry farm tomatoes, is just really, and even grapes, has really gotten the word out. Because everybody, it seems like dry farming is a buzzword now,
okay.
Just like local sustainable is, you know.
Right.
And that started with the dry farm tomatoes, and. A lot of people are doing. There was a time when I was the only one with dry farm tomatoes in the market, and now there's like four or five people doing dry farm tomatoes, and they all have little different techniques for, you know, some of them cut off the water at certain times, or some of them mulch, and some of them use the same techniques that I do. So it's all a little different, but it's water conservation, I think, is the key, and saving water
right.
and.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, how people come to that, you know, whether it's from a conservation side or whether just going back to, you know, just the older practices, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
As you say, it just started. I hadn't realized that drip irrigation only started in the 60s. That was interesting how that's taken over in every possible crop. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we use a lot of drip irrigation, too, with some of our crops, but... Another problem with dry farming is, in comparison to irrigation, is you can't reverse. You know, like I said, the double plow deal is something you can do before you plant. But after you've planted and something goes wrong or you run out of moisture because of something, you really can't go back and water. I guess you could do some kind of watering, but usually by that time it's too late to that you realize that you can do anything.
Once you've seen it, that it's too late type of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, on a piece of land, are there things physically you can do, apart from the plowing, you know, putting berms or swale? I mean, are there sort of different methods to retain water on a field that you use? Or?
Not that I use. I've heard of mulching and stuff like that, but... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just, I know if you cultivate, it'll bring moisture up also, you know, so the cultivation, which gets rid of the weeds and also brings back, stimulates the soil and brings back some moisture. But
and so now I know in grapes, they make the more gaps between the plants for dry farming. Is that the same when you're for vegetables and fruits?
Yeah, I've heard that, but no, I'm just the opposite. I plant pretty close. Like my tomatoes are very close, and this year we just goofing around. We planted two in a hole, just to see if the compatibility would what that would do, you know. And I mean, the idea is that they're getting at is that the roots need more area to survive. So they need more land because the roots need a place to spread out and find more moisture and make it easier for them to find moisture rather than crowding them and competing for moisture, the roots competing for moisture. And but I haven't tried it yet. I just like to plant it close. And I do, like with my tomatoes, which is a big crop, I sequentially plant. So we have some plantings of tomatoes 3 weeks apart so that the first planting, as it starts to, because it's different than an irrigated, fertilized, trellised tomato plant that's indeterminate and that keeps putting out, you know, volumes of tomatoes.
Right.
When you dry farm, they put out a good amount of tomatoes in the early stages of the plant, and then they start to weaken. The tomatoes get more blossom end rot and get more stressed, and the tomatoes get smaller and smaller and smaller until it's hardly worth picking. And so then that's when your other field kicks in, and you start picking that at a peak. And then when that one goes through that their cycle, then you get to the last one.
Right. So timing is everything that.
Timing is everything when you dry farm.
Yeah. Now, can you? I had a couple of questions people asking me about tomatoes specifically. You know, can it be done in a small garden? Can you really follow that type of practice to grow them?
I think in a small garden you can. I'm not sure exactly how you do it. You know, you drag a big heavy timber behind your little rototiller or something like that, but I would say mulching in a garden, do the same kind of techniques as I was calling, press the dirt down and, you know, till it up until you get a nice tilth, and then press it down, and then maybe put some mulch on it. But it's, you know, you're talking about a controlled kind of environment when, you know, a lot of the dry farming that we're relying on Mother Nature and working with Mother Nature to do it. There's a lot less control because you don't know what weeds, you know. You mentioned failed crops. One year we did have a failed crop. The radishes got so bad, the wild radish, and they just took over, the radish and the mustard just took over the field. And and by the time we did clean it up, there was hardly any potatoes left in the beds. So they just didn't, you know, it really hurt them.
Yeah.
Lost a lot of money on that crop.
Oh, dear. Yeah. So that's the...
that's one of the drawbacks.
The luck of the draw, yeah. That rolling the dice with Mother Nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, however much you do all the right things, I mean, there's only so far you can go in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you sell your produce locally? Or
Pretty much wherever I can.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it locally, I guess, what you know, within 100 miles, I guess.
Yes.
When I first started in 95, the markets here weren't that strong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was a market here in Occidental. There was one in Sebastopol, and I think there was one in Petaluma and Santa Rosa, but they were real small, and at the time everybody had gardens, so they weren't that good. So we found by going into the city, it was more appreciative, and you could sell more because they didn't have a lot of gardens in the city. So we started out going to San Francisco and Marin, and we pretty much stayed there, and thought about going to Santa Rosa. I've been asked to participate in Santa Rosa, and you know, there's some other potato growers that I knew that were selling there, and I just didn't want to compete or
impinge on their territory.
Mess the balance up or whatever. So I just stick with the markets that I do, and then I wholesale some, and I have some restaurants that I've been dealing with since 95, 96, 97, a lot of restaurants, and so I just stick with that, you know.
Well, that's wonderful to have maintained those clients over all those years. Obviously, they're very, very happy.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing, and the chefs, you know, become good friends with a lot of the chefs, and...
So you get the what's your any particular restaurant you like over over any you like to go to, or they're really good who cover your produce?
Well, I'm close with Millennium, the vegan restaurant in the city. I've known Eric, the chef owner there, since he was at Millie's in San Rafael, before I was even farming. And they buy a lot of product from me, and I really like them. And Green's restaurant as well, Annie Somerville, I've been dealing with her for a real long time. And I have some favorites. I like French Laundry, but I really like Sean from Bartisono, and I like Richard Reddington from Red's Restaurant. I think those are two really good. You know, they're all great chefs. It's just all great restaurants, and there's subtle, you know, differences.
Yeah, but that's some pretty good company you've got
there. Oh, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're speaking to David Little of Little Organic Farms out in on the Sonoma Marin County line. And David has come in to talk about dry farming in the coastal region. And it appears that it's not just experimental with David. It's been going, 15 years you've been involved in this and, mm-hmm. and doing it successfully.
Mm-hmm. I don't feel successful.
Oh, dear.
It could all end tomorrow, you know.
Yeah, unfortunately, especially with the economy the last couple of years, it's been, I'm sure it's been very, very hard.
No, actually, it's been really good. And the food industry is a real good industry to be in right now because of the economy. People still have to eat.
True.
So you might have to adjust your prices or spread out on your sales or your markets. But it's still been very good.
Hmm.
But it's a precarious profession too.
Right. Well, I'm certainly glad you're doing it, David, because we obviously need much, much more of that to preserve what we have and to preserve the soil and the water and just do good things to the earth. We can't overtax it. We've seen the results of doing that only too well.
Yeah.
You know. And so do you work in organic methods and permaculture methods to your growing?
I grow organically just because I don't know anything else.
Okay.
I'm not on any kind of into any kind of movement. I just like try and do good quality food. And, you know, I understand the Beyond Organic movement and the, you know, the certified organic movement. And you know, I'm kind of into feeding people. And, you know, that's the movement, you know.
Right.
And I think I'll do all right if I just keep putting a lot of food out there and feeding a lot of people. And, you know, I'm most proud of you know, I mentioned the French, I dropped the French Laundry name, but, you know, I'm really proud of all the charities that are able to get my seconds, starting from Healdsburg and, you know, Farm to Pantry or whatever, and then COTS in Petaluma and Meals Marin in Marin and Food Runners in San Francisco and Food Not Bombs in Berkeley. I'm really proud that I'm able to get some product to them, and that's my big deal.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's an excellent thing to do. The gleaning of the fields, like in the old biblical way, that there was all some left for those not as fortunate.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's a wonderful thing to continue.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the first couple of years when I started, I noticed that it was easier to sell vegetables than it was to give it away.
Whoa, put that on its head. Okay. Whoa, interesting.
Yeah, the first, I think it was the first or, I don't know, second or third year, I was trying to deal with Food for Thought here somewhere in Forestville.
Yeah, they're in Forestville.
And we're able to donate to them now. But at the time, the guy didn't want to come to my place. He'd meet me halfway, and he didn't show up. And, you know, that kind of, it was just a big mix-up, you know. And I went, well, this is tough.
Oh, no. Can't give it away.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm sure glad you are, and I'm glad you're producing incredible produce on a minimal watering scale. That can only be good.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David Little of the Little Organic Farms. And do you have a website or anything?
Yeah, I have a website. Yeah, it's called thelittleorganicfarm.com.
Okay. That's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got all the information about what you
contact, and what I'm doing there. And we're about ready to update it. You know, I'm way behind the times. Yeah.
Hey, at least you got one. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, David, for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Thank you.